go.
And let's do it.
Hello, hello, and welcome to And Away We Go F1 Podcast, a Formula One podcast that goes beyond the track limits to talk about travel, food, and lifestyle surrounding the sport. My name's Diane Bortoletto, and I'm your pre-Drive to Survive Formula One fan, and today I'm in Perth. And today I'm joined by Stephen Corby, who's a motoring journalist who has his own column in the Weekend Australian magazine. Well, it's not actually a column, it's like pages. And one of the best motoring journalists in the country. I feel absolutely fortunate that he's agreed to come on the podcast. So welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you very much. I feel fortunate to be here.
Tell us, are you a pre-Drive to Survive fan or a post-Drive to Survive fan? And where do we find you today? Where are you?
I'm at home and sitting in my office, pumping out the word as usual, and I'm very much a pre-Drive to Survive fan. Some of my colleagues can't watch Drive to Survive. They say they have to hide behind the couch because it's not real enough. They hate the fact that they exaggerate things and so on. But I must admit, I love Drive to Survive and I love the sport at the same time. I think it's been good for the sport and I quite enjoy watching it, even though I know it is a sugary version of Formula One.
Exactly. I mean, the first episode of Drive to Survive, I just thought this is fabulous to get all this behind the scenes access to a sport that up until that moment was really exclusive. And I just love how it's opened up the sport to so many new fans that now Formula One isn't so niche. It's mainstream. And I love that.
It is amazing how it's changed. My favorite moment was walking through the paddock a couple of years ago and Alonso was walking next to Gunter and people were cheering for Gunter. And Alonso looked at him like, what's going on? And he said, well, that's Drive to Survive, boy. I'm more famous than you. You're just a world champion driver. I'm very funny and I swear a lot.
I know, Gunter. Gosh. So you're a motoring journalist. Like, how long have you been a motoring journalist and where did that start?
Almost seems like a drive. No, I wanted to be a real journalist. I wanted to be a political journalist. So I grew up in Canberra, worked at the Canberra Times. Michelle Grattan gave me my cadetship. That's the kind of political paper it was at the time, but I was madly passionate about motorcycles. And so I begged the motoring editor to let me write about motorcycles. And that when I would pick up a bike from Sydney to ride it back into the horrible cold every week so that I can fang around Canberra like a lunatic. And I did that for years, a couple of years. And then he said to me, would you be interested in doing cars? I said, mate, cars are for soft idiots who can't ride bikes. I'm not interested. And he just kept pestering me. And he finally talked me into going on a car launch. And then I was like, I could kind of get into this. It's quite nice being treated like a prince. Then I did a few car reviews. My second ever car review was, he said, fly to Los Angeles. There's a Volvo thing on. I don't need you to write anything. It's the end of the year. They've just got some money to spend. Have a good time.
Oh, wow.
I stayed at the Beverly Hills Hilton. We stayed at Palm Cove or something. It was all just amazing. And he said, just have a good time. And I was like, okay, I will write cars for you then.
Yeah, that's a pretty good introduction into being a motoring journalist for sure. Like, go and have a free holiday and just enjoy yourself.
It was pretty good.
So where did your love for Formula One come from then? Like, were you a MotoGP fan or?
Oh, so when I was doing bikes, I covered Mick Doohan. I was absolutely mad for Wayne Gardner and Mick Doohan. I really loved the bikes back then. But my love of Formula One goes back to my stepfather, I think, I remember him losing his mind over Alan Jones. Now, that would be 1980. And so my first memories are of that. And then watching Senna and so on, it would be a big thing in my house to watch Formula One. So I was always a fan of that. Even when I was a motorcycle person, I still loved Formula One. So remembering Alan Jones very early on. And then the same boss who got me into cars was generous enough to send me to cover a Formula One race in Adelaide. I must have been very young. I must have been about 12 because that's the race that, I think it was 1994. So I must have been very young, but it was when Damon Hill was taken out by Schumacher. And I remember being there, surrounded by all these international journalists. I'm just a child, as I say, and not knowing what to do. And they're just running around like crazy. It's quite obvious that Schumacher's taken him out. And it was this incredibly huge story in Formula One. I was like, wow. And so I had to file that. So that was the first time they ever covered a Formula One race. And after that, my love of it went up 120%.
As it would. I mean, gosh, what an introduction to, you know, the world of working in F1. From that first trip to, you know, LA to cover the car launch. How did your career progress from there?
So I wanted to move to London. So I worked on the Canberra Times for a few years. I wanted to move to London. I moved there in 1997. And while I was there, I was able to establish myself more doing international trips because it's easy to be based in Europe. So I'd go to a lot of car launches. I remember going to my first big BMW launch and Jeremy Clarkson was there. And I remember thinking, oh, he's quite funny. At the time, I didn't realize the writing style. I just had to kind of push the boat out and be a bit, you know, irreverent and funny. And I thought it was unique. And then I got to London, started reading Jeremy Clarkson. This is when he just becoming a hit on Top Gear in the very early days, when it was still a bit dull before they got the magic Hammond and May thing. And I read him and thought, well, he's going much further than I do. So that's when I kind of went, you know, all the way with my writing and made it not kind of, I think it's not standard motoring journalism. It's more Top Gear style motoring journalism. So I was over there for a few years. I came back and worked on newspapers here, the Sydney Morning Herald and the Sunday Telegraph. I had a column for a few years called Mail on Sunday, which I just wrote about blokey things, which was fun. I used to talk about beer, cars, everything. And then when they launched Top Gear magazine in Australia, they came and poached me from the newspapers and said, you're the only person for this job. So I was the editor of Top Gear magazine for a few years, which was just enormous fun. We could just do whatever we wanted. You know, the budget, car companies were willing to do anything to be in the magazine. The first thing we did was take an Audi R8 supercar up, Big Red, which is like this the world's biggest sand dune. Totally destroyed the car. They never got it back. I think it's still out there somewhere. Oh, but it was a great story, great photography, you know. So that was the kind of madness you could engage in Top Gear. I was there for probably 5 or 6 years, and then they asked me to go and edit Wheels magazine because they wanted to try and change the tone of that. And so I did Wheels magazine for a year, and then it moved to Melbourne. I didn't move to Melbourne with it, and now I've been freelance ever since, probably 7 or 8 years now freelance. And the freelancing just means I write for as many people as I possibly can. I have lots of different outlets, and I still occasionally write for Wheels magazine. And the column in the Weekend Australian is the one kind of constant in my life. I write that every week, but I write as much as I can for everyone else, different websites, whatever. Yes, that's all the car stuff.
And what are your favourite things to write? Like, what do you get excited about writing?
Well, there are certain car launches that sort of stick in the mind. This year I went and drove the F80, and I up there, and I thought, if I stop now, that's okay, because this is the ultimate. I've done the greatest car ever made. So the F80 has 1,200 horsepower. A Formula One car had 1,000 horsepower.
Wow.
So it's more powerful and slightly quicker to 100 kilometers an hour than F1 car. The F1 car would hose you by the time we get into 200, but in initial brake, it would the F1 car wouldn't quite keep up with the F80s. So it's a road
car. Where was that? Was that in Australia?
No, we drove it at Misano, which is a superbike track. They said they chose that track because there's one particularly fast corner. They said you need to hit the apex of that corner at 250, because only 250 will you feel max downforce. And I was like, do you mean in the middle of the corner? We'd be 250. And they're like, yeah, you'll be fine. I wasn't fine. I think I got to 220 was the fastest I got to that corner. It was still terrifying. But that car does feel like an F1 car. So maxed to the ground with downforce that it allows you to do things through corners you just can't do in other cars. And it also has Formula One technology in so much the way the power is delivered. There's electric motors at the front, there's an engine at the rear, and it just has constant torque vectoring and grip, so that at all times you feel like you were nailed to the ground. So it's a bit like a Formula One car, except that they don't have the advantage of traction control. You know, their traction control is their right foot. This thing makes you feel like a Formula One driver, but you don't need to be anywhere near as talented.
Wow, what an experience. Jeez, how did you recover after that?
It was.
Where do you go from there?
It was entirely bonkers, but we went and got another Ferrari and drove the Stelvio Pass, which I also enjoyed. So that's one of the world's most famous roads. This phenomenal 32 hairpins, I think it is, and we did a drive up and down there, which was quite good. But I don't think anything will ever compare now to that. So it's hard to find an experience like that. But those are the great ones. Those super, you drive cars and you go to racetracks and they're all great. But supercars like Ferraris and Lamborghinis and so on, it really is like the dream I had as a teenager with a poster of a Lamborghini on my wall. You can't believe it's really happening to you. So those things are fun and easy to write. I mean, I think I wrote the F80 5 different times. Each of those stories was easy to write because there is so much to say. I could have written a book about it.
I bet. Wow. Geez, you're just living my dream, actually. That's I would love to do something like that. That's just incredible. So Formula One has been part of your life ever since you were a kid. And you've covered F1 a few times in your careers. Tell us some stories about that.
So yeah, it's been my passion as well as the work thing. So because you work in the area, you can occasionally get media passes. So having that kind of backstage access, being in the paddock and seeing the people. I know they're drivers, but also kind of like, for me, years before drivers, they feel like huge celebrities to me. So to be in person-to-person interviews with Schumacher was amazing. I always claim that he's actually a robot. I saw him quite close up and he seems to have no pores in his skin. Did you ever see him with even a slow Spivercock shadow? I don't think so. He was not human. And I think that the same robotic technology was used to create Max Verstappen. Have you ever seen a hair on his face? I've seen him close up and he just looks grumpy. But so meeting them and coming to be in awe of what they do is something. So I went to Silverstone just as a kind of I didn't have to work. I just went to watch it. And I remember always Schumacher coming through the first corner and having this different line to everyone else. And you could see that he was faster than everyone else. I get chills talking about it. Like, it was so moving for me to see that. And in those days, the noise of the Formula One cars made, the fact that it would go through you like a rotary blade tearing your sternum apart, that was just so incredible. So every chance I got to go to a Formula One race, I would go. The ultimate experience that changed the way I feel about Formula One entirely, which is not many people get to do it, but I got to go at the last minute. They called, said, can you come to Melbourne tomorrow and go in the two-seater Minardi? So I flew down to Melbourne and there's a two-seater there. Paul Stoddart's there to tie you in. This woman gets out before me. She's a tall model. She was the face of Formula One. Yeah, she got out and started vomiting in the bin. She was so sick. They put me in, they strap you in. I'm behind the driver. And they make you cross your arms like this and they give you a dead man's button. So you've got to hold this button down because if you pass out, a light will come on the driver's dash so that he doesn't hurt you. Because once you pass out, your neck will be doing this too much. So you have to hold the dead man's button as hard as you can. I'm like, who's going to pass out? He said, oh, you know, it does happen. And then off you go 300 plus down the straight. The most physically far, I've been in a lot of race cars. I've been lucky enough to sit next to Peter Brock. And phenomenal rally driver, but I've never felt anything like that Formula One car. It was the G-force. There's a long right-hand corner in Melbourne, and every time I watch the race now, it still comes back to me how hard I was being pushed like this. I couldn't breathe. I'm just being pushed to the side. You're just going, please, God, make this corner be over. And then you just start to breathe again. And then they hit the brakes, and the first time you hit the brakes, you think you're in an accident. You think they made a mistake. Oh, my God, we're going to hit the wall. They hit the brakes. The G-force is just so intense. And all I'm trying to do is just breathe. You can't see because there's a block in front of you and then the driver, he's driving me. And I just turned my head to try and look and like it just about ripped your head off. All I could think was, I can't physically deal with being in the car. How do they drive it, think at the same time and race each other? All he was doing, just us on the track. I flew home to Sydney that night. 8 hours later, I was still lying under my desk because I still felt sick. It actually, I don't normally get motion sick in cars, but it had crushed my insides to the point where I struggled to recover, which is why when I watch that F1 movie and Brad Pitt 60-something gets in the car and drives, I just don't buy it. Sorry, yeah. zero stars from me.
I've got a two-seater story as well, not nearly as awesome as yours. When I first started working in PR, was in London in the late 90s, so we were there around the same time, and I was working for an agency that had the Orange Arrows Formula One account. And I was a junior back then, and we had a track day in the two-seater Formula One car. And Johnny Herbert was driving it that day, and we had the editor from Mobile Magazine. Orange were paying for this day, the mobile phone provider. So we put the editor, she was a tiny little thing, so nervous about going in the two-seater, and she made her nerves known to everybody. Anyway, she gets in the car. Johnny Herbert does, you know, I think only 3 laps of Silverstone, and we get back. And like you described, she just ran to the bathroom and she was in there for ages. She comes out, she's white, you know, Johnny Herbert's there and he's like, are you all right? You all right? And she's like, oh, I don't know. You know, and he goes, you know the mistake that you made? She said, what? And he said, you told me you were nervous. I just clocked my fastest time. And I was just like, Johnny, like, here we are trying to generate positive media coverage. Anyway, we got front cover, so the client was happy and it ended up being a fabulous story. But that was the first time I had been trackside and heard a, you know, not a proper Formula One car, a two-seater Formula One car, but heard that. And just the vibrations that go through your body, like you said, is, oh, it's totally addictive. I just couldn't get enough of it after that.
And it was the V10. The V10 was its most incredible. So it's the only thing that I missed that now going to Formula One. The first time I ever took my stepfather to Melbourne, he came with me and he said he'd grown up going to Bathurst and so on. He's a big fan of all that. I said, you'll need earplugs. He said, mate, you know what you're talking about. I don't know. No one needs earplugs. I said, well, I'll put them in. Yeah. I put them in and all the V10s come down the street. And he's like screaming in pain trying to put the earplugs in. You couldn't stand there without earplugs. Now, you don't really need them. I mean, they sound good, but they used to sound so piercing. There's a great video of Lewis Hamilton being interviewed in the pits and you hear the V10 go past behind him, like they're running, I think, this two-seater and just goes, oh, listen to that. You learn the drivers miss it too. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, it really was something. And actually, I didn't wear earplugs because I just loved it so much. And I wasn't exposed to it for a whole race with, you know, 20-odd cars going around. It was just the two-seater, but it was brilliant. Wow. You've had some experiences, not just with Formula One drivers, but I've heard you spent some time with Nicole Piastri.
I did. We one of the best Grand Prix experiences I had. I went with McLaren to Singapore, it must have been two years ago. And there was this incredible thing where Piastri got up on stage and he was asked a lot of questions. He's in the McLaren kind of corporate box. And then this woman is like waving at him madly from the front row. And he's like, oh, and that's my mum there. And she runs up and hands him Tim Pans and Colgate for some reason. And just we must have better toothpaste. And he gives her a big hug and he says, I've got to go now. And he leaves. And I go and talk to her. And it's his mum. He goes, that's the first time I've seen him. I probably won't see him again this weekend because he just doesn't have time. That was the only chance you got to see him. But then we spent the 3 days with her. She's hilarious. And people who follow her on Twitter will know. And the most amazing she told me about him is that he's quite fearful. He said he's just one of those fearful kids, like he wouldn't run too fast down a hill. He wouldn't do something like skiing. He'd be too scared. I said, are you aware of what it is that he does for a living? How is he not frightened of that? He said, he just has this weird thing where that doesn't scare him, despite being quite a fearful person. I don't think any Formula One driver, I always say that the difference between Formula One drivers or racing drivers in general and humans is they don't feel fear. If I approach a corner at 200 plus, I'm thinking, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. They're thinking, how fast can I go? Can I go a bit further? If the car gets loose, they quite enjoy that. They like not the parts of their brain that should light up at that point with self-preservation do not exist. And I've discussed with lots of racing drivers, Mick Doohan in particular, he didn't understand fear until he had his son, Jack. And then I said, okay, so when you watch Jack, do you feel fear then? He said, yes. He said, the first time I saw him racing, I felt so sorry for my parents. He said, but now I understand how awful that is. He said, so I don't feel fear for myself, but I can feel fear watching him. And he said, yeah, it's weird that feeling. It must be awful feeling fear like you normal human beings.
Yeah. I've always said that Max Verstappen, what sets him above everybody else is that he's just not afraid to die. Like he's just not, that thought doesn't even cross his mind, you know, which is why he takes risks and why he's just elbows out and drives so aggressively. Well, that's one theory of mine anyway.
Absolutely. And the fact that they can have an accident, get back in the car and not be slower. Like you think anyone else, if you have a spin or something, you get back on your the self-preservation kicks in, you're a little bit nervous, they're just back on it again. And there's no hesitation, if you had fear, normal fear, like the rest of us feel, I don't think you could drive like that. It certainly would slow you down when you have a crash. It never slows it down. Same with motorcycles. I remember seeing Kevin Schwantz glide off the bike at the end of Eastern Creek and slide about 800 meters. His leathers were burned. He just got up and ran back to the pit and got on another bike. Like, I would feel shaken. He just feels like, yeah. Oh, that's annoying. Let's go and do it again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, this is ruining my lap. Let's go, you know, try again. I know. They've got a different chromosome, I think, than the rest of us normal Joes out here. Yeah. So Nicole's hilarious, and she told you about that, about Oscar, that he's strangely quite fearful off the track and out of the car. Was that just as a kid, do you think, or? Like
she said he was always a fearful kid, and that I said, "Did he like that now?" She said, "A bit, but obviously not. But not when it comes to car racing." She said, but you just wouldn't believe the kind of person he is when you consider what he does for a living. But she's also just she's the merciless in taking the piss out of him and telling funny stories about him, that kind of thing. And she's just full of energy and bubble and so on. She did actually get to see him at the end of the race. I saw she got like they got 5 minutes together with the family. But she said it's just so difficult to get any time with him and how much they enjoy it when he comes back to Melbourne, because it's so rare. And you think, you know, he went away as a 14-year-old kid pretty much on his own to live in England. And my daughter's 14, I can't imagine that. It's just like also the idea of, you know, Antonelli racing at 18 years old, like they're children. Like the pressure and the physical difficulty of what they're doing. And yet you forget also how that Oscar is still very, very young. I mean, he stands there in his shorts, actually, Nick DeLando, he still looks very young.
Exactly right. And I listened to an interview with Gabrielle Bortoletto, who I joke is my cousin because we've got the same surname, but a different spelling, one T, not two. And he went to Italy as a kid as well, as a 14-year-old, but he didn't have like a chaperone. He wasn't in boarding school. He lived above a garage and was working in a mechanics kind of garage during the day, as well as doing some racing and in Italy. And I was like, oh my God, like no one to look after him, look out for him, look, just insane.
I guess they mature very fast. I mean, Oscar seems very mature and always has. He seems to have like an old person's head on his shoulders. But I think that kind of experience must mold you in a way that you know you can't imagine. And just the drive to want it that much, that this is what I want to do and I'm willing to, you know, not be with my family, like kind of thing, not see my sister, not be there for birthdays, but I'm here, I'm going to make a career of it. And you got to remember that we talk about the ones who make it, but 95, 98% of people don't make it. It's the same.
Exactly. You know, and it always astounds me when you hear of families who uproot and move to Europe or move across the other side of the world to follow a 13-year-old's dream. I'm like, gosh, that dream would have to be set in concrete, right? To uproot the whole family, for everybody to change their lives and move overseas. You know, it's not like me learning guitar in year six and then giving it away 6 months later because I didn't like carrying my guitar to school every week. You know, it's just, you'd want to have a solid commitment. It's such a big call. Like, imagine all the kids that have got that commitment and the families just can't support them in that way.
And you need to look at Daniel Ricciardo, his family then, you know, uproot themselves and go to Europe and throw everything at him having that career. But like, Ricciardo's lucky that his family have money. The more incredible story of Mark Webber, who gets there without the money. And will that ever happen again? You've got to have some kind of financial backing as well as the emotional encouragement of your parents to say,
exactly.
You know, it's a very expensive sport to get into. You've got to have money behind you all the way.
Yeah, it sure is. So speaking of Mark Webber, you've spoken to him. Haven't you? You've interviewed him before. Yeah, tell us what that was like.
Well, the last time I saw him, I was at this dinner and there were probably six journalists there, five of whom were like influencers who might have heard of Drive to Survive but weren't that interested. And so they sort of started chatting amongst themselves. And I'm like sitting there just with Mark Webber asking everything I could think of to ask about Formula One and different tracks. And then I made this horrible mistake of saying, oh, I remember that year when you were going to win the world championship and you had that horrible spin in the rain in Korea. You know, I was really upset. I was watching it on TV and I'm really annoyed and geez, that was bad. And he's looking at him with this look of horror on his face. He goes, oh, was it? It was a bad tweet, was it? He said, do you think I forgot about it? Yeah, I do remember that actually. Thanks so much for bringing it up. Why don't you give me a paper cut and put a lemon on it? It's
Oh, God.
So that was awkward. That was very awkward.
How old were you? Like,
oh, that was only like 2 years ago.
He does
some work for Porsche. So he was at a Porsche thing. He constructed the drive program for us because he has a house in Noosa. He said, oh, these are the roads you should drive around here. At the end of the day, he's there to talk to you about the car, but really, you just want to ask him about Formula One and nerd out, which I always do when I see him. But he's great. He's got fantastic stories about hanging out with Tom Cruise and so on. He lives this lifestyle that you can't quite imagine. It's quite remarkable.
And, like, it's just brilliant that he's, I guess, helped shape Oscar's career and he's there to mentor him. I did see somebody comment that on social along the lines of Mark Webber's demons of his paranoia of the team favouring somebody else is going to ruin Oscar's chance for a world championship. Like, have you got any thoughts about that?
I saw something horrible as well when people were having a go at Oscar and it just said halfway through the season Oscar loses the grip, Oscar be like, and it was just a picture of Mark Webber in a Red Bull outfit. It's like, you know, I thought that was particularly cruel to bring up that comparison. But I just think he's a fantastic manager for him. He's so measured and driven. So he was, I saw him at the start of the year at the Melbourne Grand Prix and we were talking about Oscar and he was so confident then. He said, this is going to be his year. You watch. He's learned so much about time and he's learned so much in the last year. I think the car's going to, you'll be surprised how fast the car is and people will stop asking me whether it was the right decision to take him out of Renault and put him in McLaren. This is the year that people will stop asking me that question. So no, I don't buy that entirely that it is paranoia. I mean, I don't think that they're messing with the car is probably a conspiracy theory too far, but the idea that they're favouring Lando is simply clear to me, and Mark Webber will fight like crazy against that as much as he can. But I don't think it's a disadvantage having him in your corner. And it's one thing that the English commentators with all of their bias often regularly point to. He's very lucky to have Mark Webber in his corner.
Yep, definitely. I've been saying all season as well that this is Oscar's year and you can just see how much he's improved since, you know, he started Formula One, but even just on some race weekends, and I've said this before, like he might start FP1, FP2, FP3, and I know that the free practices, they're setting up the car and they're testing different tyres, etc. So it's not a true indication of times. But, you know, you see where he might not be taking a corner as fast as someone else and whatever, but come quali or come race day, he's on it. Like he just learns every single session. And I honestly don't think there's a better driver on the grid that does that. You know, takes the mistakes, takes the data, the analysis, and then applies it to improve lap times.
And it's an amazing thing. I always think when they come in at the end of a session, they can look at exactly what Lando is doing. They can see where Lando is broken. They can see his approach angle in the corner. You can look at it and go, could I do that better or am I better off doing it my way? And as Villeneuve said the weekend, every single racing driver drives slightly differently. And there is a difference in approach. And that's, even though it's a breadth between them sometimes, it's that little approach, that little bit later that Max goes in, or that angle he gets at Austin through the corner. The differences are so amazing, but he does seem to have the ability to apply that information and get faster through the sessions, or he did until recently. So I must ask you, do you still think it's his year?
Do I still think it's Oscar's year? I do. I think now that he's on the back foot, now that he's the hunter rather than the hunted, I think that'll just ignite something extra in him. And like, he's had a taste of leading the world championship, and I think he'll fight like crazy to get it. I think the only reason he won't win the World Drivers Championship this year is if there's issues with the car, if there's bad calls from the team, like strategy or tyre management, or if the team stuff him up really, or if there's bad luck, like if he's taken out, has an accident through no fault of his own. I do think Oscar's got what it takes. Yeah, I'm not losing hope yet.
No. At this point, so you just take one DNF, doesn't it? The thing, a DNF would be a disaster for any of those three drivers now. So
exactly.
Just hope that doesn't happen. You don't want it to be decided like that.
No, exactly. And those three drivers we're talking about, of course, Lando Norris, Max Verstappen, and Oscar Piastri. So have you got a Formula One team? Is there, you know, have you always followed an F1 team or an F1 driver? Like, who do you support?
It's weird, isn't it? Because unlike other sports, you tend to follow a team. My team is always dependent on who the driver is. And so, you know, I was a Senna fan, so therefore I should be a McLaren fan. But when Mark Webber comes in, wherever Mark Webber was driving, that was my team. So now it's very much Piastri. Wherever Piastri's been, I'm following that guy. I do like the McLaren team, but if for some reason Oscar suddenly went and drove somewhere else, I would suddenly be a fan of that team.
Okay. Do you still like the McLaren team, given how the favouritism is really clear towards Lando?
Yeah, I should have used the past tense. I had always liked the McLaren teams until recently. Well, I tell you, my great fear is I think the next race will be pivotal. If Lando opens a gap in the next race and Verstappen is still getting closer, then I won't be surprised if they say, look, to make sure that we win the world championship, we have to prioritise the driver in front with the most points. Now, they could have done that a couple of weeks ago. Might have been wise once Max started winning races, but I won't be surprised if it happens. There'll be outrage and we'll all be annoyed down here, but everyone in England and the Sky commentators will tut-tut and stroke their beards and go, well, it's the right thing to do. And if it does happen, I'll be horrified. But I think Oscar really needs to put points on the board and get in front again, so that if that happens, it's going to happen to him. But I also think they wouldn't do it if it's him. And then they stand a real chance of, you know, Max Verstappen stealing it somehow, which would be just the worst of all possible outcomes.
Yeah. Like, if Oscar doesn't win the world championship, I hope it's Max. And I'm not a Max Verstappen fan, only because the whole Lando favouritism has been so blatant and the whole British media are so blinkered to it. It's crazy. And they say, oh, your Australian fans are biased. Okay, I am. I'll own it. So if it's not Oscar, then, I mean, obviously I would prefer it to be Ferrari because I am a Ferrari fan. I'm an Oscar Piastri fan first and then a Ferrari fan equal first. I can't believe I've actually been cheering for Max Verstappen this season, which is just something I never thought I'd find myself doing.
I always argue with people who are fans of Max's dad, right? I have to say, but why? What is it you like about the fact that he's willing to break the rules, seriously injure or kill other drivers, put a bother in, would have killed Hamilton if it wasn't for the halo, all that.
Gosh, just
the ruthlessness of him. Like, he's a racing driver. He's such a great racing driver. I think he's physically the most talented racing driver in the world. I think he is the best. And if you put them all in the same car on the same track, I think he would probably win because A, he's probably a little bit faster, but B, he's willing to take everyone else out. I just don't like that side of him. So I have to say, I think I'd be bitter and twisted if Lando wins, but I'd still prefer that to Max getting another one.
Yeah, fair enough. That's why this world is such an interesting place. If we all had the same opinions, it'd be boring. So
that's true.
With Max, I guess I've liked seeing a different side of him in recent times, seeing him with Kelly, seeing him with his daughter, which has not changed his driving at all since he's become a father, and also seeing him not win every week. Like, when he was winning everything, I couldn't stand him. And that said, I was exactly the same with Lewis Hamilton when he was dominating. I was just like, oh, here we go again. And truth be told, in 2021, when it was between Lewis and Max, I really didn't want Lewis breaking Michael Schumacher's record of 7 world titles because I'm a massive Shoei fan. But now I really want to see Lewis get an 8th in a Ferrari. I don't know when it's going to happen. Like, it just feels like it's almost an impossible dream, but we live in hope. You never know what next year will bring with the new regulations. So
Well, that's the great thing about the new regulations. Next year, all the cars go up in the air. We don't know where they're going to fall. And if Ferrari come with a fast car, as they kind of did when Schumacher got there, that I think next year is his last chance. But in that case, if the car was super fast, it would be a hell of a fight with Charles, because I think he's a very, very good driver. And I think that Hamilton, as much as he might like to be, one of the most interesting things that Webber ever said to me was about, I asked him why he retired when he did. He said, you just can't drive past about 34. He said, you're only losing a tiny bit here and there. He said, it's like a hundredth to here and a hundredth there, but in Formula One, that's too much. He said, you just can't go. And I could feel it. He said, I'm getting older. It's slowing down. My reactions aren't there. And I see him a few years later and say, well, how is Alonso doing it? And he goes, I don't know. He said, the thing with Alonso is he has no other hobbies. He has no other interests in life. All he wants to do is drive cars. He said, I'm happy to go and do other things, but Alonso just wants to keep doing it. I asked him again about Lewis this year. He said, honestly, I remember saying that. I don't understand how anyone can continue to do it at that age. He said, because you've got to be slipping a little bit. It's like a cricketer, you know, Ricky Ponting was amazing, but now admits that at the end, he did slow down a little bit. It's just the tiniest margins change. The human body ages, the brain slows down. But I think Hamilton's probably got one more year. I think a lot of people would love to see it. I do think that if he'd won the contentious race and he'd won that season, I think he would have retired. I mean, it would have been almost mad not to. And it would have been the best finish. That's what's so annoying about it. He should have won that race.
Oh, I mean, what are we talking? 4 years ago, and we're still talking about it.
It still hurts.
It does still hurt. I mean, I wasn't hoping for Max to win that race because it was so unfair the way it was done. But I was also, like I said, not wanting Michael Schumacher's record to be taken off him because he was just a hero of mine for many, many years.
But it did create the best season of Drive to Survive. It was a hell of a show. And it was great drama that only Formula One can provide, that kind of unexpected. It looks like it's over, but it's not. Like that, you so thought he had it, and then the crash at the wrong time, everything goes out. I remember just like driving home, kicking cats all the way home. I was just so angry. At 2 a.m, I think it was too. Been up till 2 a.m. For no good reason.
You're right. It still does hurt. It just still feels wrong. And what about Felipe Massa, like doing Formula One for being robbed of his championship? What's your opinion on that?
It's amazing. I mean, I was at that race, the crash gate race. And at the time, when the rumors started going around, you're like, well, this is not possible. No one would do that. Like, what team would say to your driver, crash into the wall? So I think, I mean, he has at least morally, he has a case, doesn't he? But and there's Flavio banned from the sport forever for his part in it.
Yeah, right.
And there he is back now, kicking, ruining Jack Doohan's life. Looking grumpy in the pits. I mean, that's a weird lifetime ban, isn't it? I mean, it's so wrong. And that's what, when you think about, when people talk about conspiracies in Formula One, I always point back to that one and say, you think this sounds mad, it's impossible. How mad was that? But it actually happened. It's crazy.
Yeah, exactly. So,
I do feel for Felipe, yes.
I feel for him as well. But it's kind of like, what are you going to achieve by winning this court case besides being able to say you're a Formula One champion? Like, you've missed all the glory days. You've missed... Yeah. And it just feels like a lot of stress, like having to go through a high court case, which I think that's the next step, isn't it?
It'd leave the account team winning. But you could always argue that there were so many other variables. Is that the only reason you didn't win? You know, so that's the cross argument would be Alonso would have beaten you in many other ways. So I don't know. I think, as I say, morally, I feel like he has a case, but I don't know that legally it's that strong. We shall see.
Yeah. He should probably play that moral card and win not the sympathies, but the support of the wider fan base and build up his following that way. I think he might get more joy from that than...
I did enjoy seeing him in the Braun documentary. You know, in the Braun documentary, they talk about the horrible incident with his helmet. He's still got the helmet. That was amazing. You forget how that was. The other thing interesting about the Braun documentary in that year is how close it is to what's happening now. So whenever they go to Jensen and say, do you think Oscar's feeling the pressure at this point of the season? He's been in front, everyone thinks he's going to win, and now his teammate's coming back, and I'm thinking, well, no one is better placed to answer these questions than you, Jensen. Please let us know. So yeah, you do see that comparison for sure.
Yeah, I do really like Jensen Button's commentary, especially when he's paired with Danica Patrick. It's just comedy gold. Just watching,
you've read my mind. You don't watch her, you just watch his face. Just trying to keep it together, and just like you can see, it's like a silent groan. You can see the groan trying to get out of his body. Like she says something, and he just wants to groan. He's like trying to hold it in.
Oh,
dude, that's so intelligent what you just said.
You're offering so much insight and value to the viewers. It's just this, it's comedy gold just watching that. Well, Monaco is a race that we've both been to, but you experienced it way differently to me. I think I was there in 2014. When did you go? And tell us about your experience in Monaco.
I think it was 2020, and there is an Australian tour group that takes people over there, and you can, for a certain amount of money, you stay in a hotel in Neath, and then you have these choices of how you want to get to your super yacht in the morning. You can helicopter in, you can get a boat in. I just went to the boat. Daniel Ricciardo was on the boat next to us waving in. And then you park in this three-level super yacht just behind one of the grandstands. You can see the cars going past. And it's just amazing. From the morning espresso martinis to the end of the day when they're doing laybacks, it's giant bottles of vodka as big as this. And constant entertainment, magicians, live bands, the most amazing food you've ever seen. But the weird thing that happens in Monaco that I didn't know about was boat hopping. So in the afternoon when everyone's had a lot of free champagne, you just start hopping boats. I ended up four boats down in a spa bath on the third floor of a super yacht with a Dutch pop singer who was singing in Dutch. And was like, oh, you're so lucky to be here with whatever his name was, and Francis Garner. And that was very odd. So that was cool. But a part of the experience as well is that you get grandstand tickets. So you can at any point go and sit in the grandstand. I think out of the 40 people on the boat, I was the only person who used the grandstand tickets. Most of them are like, why would I leave the boat? But I want to go and sit with that right at the swimming pool and watch them come through there. Amazing. And the other thing you would know about Monaco is that the track itself becomes a nightclub. At night, when we were there, the Rascasse becomes a nightclub. There's pole dancing and lights and everything. And in the morning, they just scrub the glass away and it becomes a racetrack again. No place like it. And as a party, it is definitely the most fun one to go to. The thing is, I can tell you that the tickets, the super yacht experience and everything was at the time, and I don't think it's gone up much, $12,000 for the 3 days. And I ate and drank at least $14,000 worth of value out of that. And I did it as a travel story. That's why I was there doing it as a travel story for several people. And I would honestly spend my own money to do it again. I keep talking about that. I will do it again. It's a bucket list to go back and do it again with friends of mine who are huge Formula One fans. I'm like, it sounds like a lot of money, but it is worth every dollar.
Well, yeah, we just were plebs in the grandstand. It was a last minute decision that we made 2 weeks before. I had a trip to Italy, a work trip to Sicily, actually, that fell through at the last minute. And it was like, well, we're going to be in Italy anyway. You know, Monaco really is just up the road. Shall we go to the Monaco Grand Prix? And my husband, who was a lukewarm Formula One fan at the time, just went, yeah, sure. So I just booked tickets. I didn't even tell him how much it cost. And we're talking like 11 years ago. It was $1,500 for the both of us to get a wooden plank with two lines painted on it that said 55 and 56. No backs, just a grandstand, just a plank seat opposite the marina. And it was just the greatest day of our lives. It was brilliant. Like right downstairs, right under the grandstand was a Heineken bath. Not once was there a queue. We just got €8 pints and we sat there and just had just an awesome day. Daniel Ricciardo finished second in that race. And I was watching people like you on the super yachts with their back to the track half the time. Guys, turn around, you idiots. What's happening? Like,
that's what struck me. I think it was €800 a day for the grandstand, to sit in the grandstand. I was like, well, if you're paying that much, just chip on the extra and get on a super yacht, I reckon.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems impossible, but there are these companies that do it. And I was like, well, that's a pretty good option. And you can actually carry on the Monday. You can drive a Formula One car, which I was supposed to do. They said every year on the Monday, someone drops out.
Formula One car?
Yeah, so you can drive a Formula One car. You go to Paul Ricard. You go through the day, you start with Formula Renault and they build up and build up. And as long as you don't crash any of the car, at the end of the day, you get to drive a Formula One car. So that's part of this tour as well. You can add that on as a package. But every single year until I was there, someone had dropped out on the Monday because they were too hungover. They said, we'll call you at 6 in the morning. Someone won't come. Always two or three people drop out. I'm sitting there waiting by the phone, and everyone turned up that day. 80% of them didn't get to the Formula One car. They couldn't progress through the stages. So that's that was upsetting. And then they come back on Monday night, and then for the next 5 days, you drive across Europe in 12 different supercars, staying at 5-star resorts, and that's part of the whole package. So you can do just the Monaco bit, or you do the entire European supercar tour, which starts with the race and ends in the Champagne region with a champagne drinking experience. And that all together is a lot more than 12,000, but it is. That's dream holiday stuff. Not for journalists, obviously, but for people with real jobs.
Well, for journalists, if they're able to be hosted and write about it and tell the world about it, but on a journalist's salary, perhaps it's just how the other half live, right? People that are super fans that just save up and, you know,
do it once. Just do it once. It's a bucket list thing, and why not?
Exactly.
That's what superannuation's for. I keep telling my wife.
That's exactly right. Well, Stephen, just before we jump into the final three, let me ask you this. What is it that you love about Formula One? One sentence.
To me, it's the notion, it's the knowledge I have of what they're doing in the car that makes it feel so rich to me, because I know how fast a car is and how hard it is to drive. I used to love the sport of it and the politics of it and all that kind of thing, but now I just have the utmost respect for what they're doing in the car, and that's what I love. And particularly if it's a track that I've been to, I can feel and see what it is they're doing, and it blows my mind.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Well, the final three questions, these are questions that we ask every guest that comes on the podcast. If you could travel for a holiday to any Formula One destination, whether it's race week or non-race week, current or former, where would you choose to go on a holiday and why?
Oh, non-race week would be tough. I'm going to have to say Spa, because that's the race I most want to see. And then, having lived in Europe a couple of times, I regret enormously that I didn't make it happen. And my colleagues have been to Spa. I gave up a ticket to go and drive the new Nissan GTR around Spa, and my colleagues went and did that, to drive through Eau Rouge and do all that. And they said it was absolutely mind-boggling. So that's the one I have to go to, because it's the race, I think, that still has the best racing. And nothing annoys me more than the fact that it's not a full-time part of the calendar anymore, because that is awful.
Yeah, I know.
And the drivers running around, nobody wants that. We've got all these races in the Middle East and America. Vegas is seen as like a slightly pointless race. But if I was going to go anywhere for a holiday and non-race week that is a Formula One destination, it would probably be Austin, which is also another Grand Prix I want to go to, but Austin's a fantastic town.
So if you could holiday with any Formula One driver, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Well, it would have been Villeneuve in the past, but since he's become a commentator, I find that he's becoming... He seems to be one of those people who says outrageous things for the sake of getting attention. And he doesn't feel like the same Villeneuve that when Villeneuve won the World Championship. I was watching it at NEC in Birmingham at a motor show. There were thousands of people there, and Clarkson was on stage watching it with a microphone. And when Schumacher and Villeneuve had the incident, the places went wild. And I made a bet with several friends that if Villeneuve won, I would dye my hair blonde. My hair used to be brown. And so I dyed my hair blonde and spiked it like Villeneuve. That's how much of a fan I was of him at the time.
Yeah,
but
right.
Now... my answer to that would definitely be Eddie Irvine.
Yeah, right.
Because he's a party boy and he's good fun. And he was doing the grid walk the other day, and Martin ran into him and he was just like being horribly inappropriate. Martin had to walk away. But he still, he said, I'm mates with, you know, the boss of Irvine. I still get a ticket. But he just seems like he's exactly the same lad that he always was. And I think I would like to have a holiday with him in Dublin.
Oh, God, that would just be wild. That would be, I was a fan of him. Eddie Irvine back in the day. Now, I don't know if you're much of a cook. So if you're not a cook, then what would you like to eat? If you were to cook or eat a Formula One themed meal, a cuisine from any race destination, what would you choose to cook or eat and why?
I wish I could cook it, but I would have char kway teow from the hawker market in Singapore. And every time I go to the race in Singapore, I go there and have it. It's one of those tiny little places that has a Michelin star because the char kway teow is so good, and get it extra spicy. It is phenomenal. It's one of my favorite things to eat in the world, and that would definitely be it. But there are a million answers to that question. I would also go for barbecue in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
Also very good. And again, I wish I could cook it as well as they can. When you get off at the airport in Austin, you can smell it. I think there's a barbecue place in the airport, and you can smell barbecue from the moment you get there. I've been there, and I've woken up in the middle of the night with meat sweats because I've eaten so much barbecue meat.
Oh, God.
And get up and do it all again.
Oh, fabulous. Oh, what an amazing chat. Thank you so much, Stephen Corby. I've thoroughly enjoyed this, and I feel like I could just sit here all day and listen to all of your F1 and motoring stories. I bet there's a ton more that you've got banked there. So thank you very much for coming on the podcast and sharing them with us.
No problem. I've written them all into a book. It's coming out next year. I don't know what it's going to be called yet, but the book is coming. So all the stories will be in there.
Well, make sure you share it with us when the book is published, and maybe we'll get you back on the podcast to talk about it then.
When it comes back, we'll come and chat about it. Sure.
Absolutely. Sounds great. Well, on that note, if you've liked what you've heard, subscribe, rate, review the podcast. You can find us on all the podcast listening apps, also on LinkedIn, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And you can also email us, and away we go, F1podcast@gmail.com. Well, that's all we've got time for this week. Thank you very much, Stephen. Until next week and until lights out.
It's lights out and away we go.
And Away We Go podcast is produced by Diane Bortoletto.
Let's do it.